Enron, WorldCom, Global Crossing, Tyco, Adelphia. Are these just bad apples, or the tip of an iceberg representing a much larger problem? Join us as we pull away the corporate veil and look under the covers to see corporations behaving badly. That's Mike Stout with Big Time Corporate Blues. Have you got them? If so, you're in the right place. This is KUCI in Irvine, broadcasting live at 88.9 in your FM dial and streaming live 24/7 on your computer at www.kuci.org. The show is Corporations Behaving Badly, and I'm your host, Steve Spanier. Before we begin, it's important to note that the opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily shared by KUCI, its management, or the Regents of the University of California. On this program, we take a long, hard look at the corporate-controlled world in which all of us live. Join us as we weave our way through topics such as globalization and free trade, privatization, corporate crime, immigration, affluenza, campaign finance reform, consolidation of the media, and others. In the process, you'll hear the opinions of worldwide experts and learn about new books, films, and other art forms addressing these topics. So buckle up and listen in as over the next hour we discuss topics affecting all our lives. But be prepared. This is scary stuff. Don't listen if you're easily frightened. Our guest this morning is Stacy Mitchell. Stacy is a senior researcher with the New Rules Project, a program of the nonprofit Institute for Local Self-Reliance. A frequent speaker at conferences and public forums, she has advised numerous communities on strategies and policies to limit chain store proliferation and strengthen locally owned businesses. Her latest book, Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Businesses, published by Beacon Press this year, was described by author Bill McKibben as the ultimate account of the single most important economic trend in our country. Mitchell regularly contributes articles and commentaries to magazines and newspapers and produces an acclaimed monthly email newsletter, the Hometown Advantage Bulletin. She lives in Portland, Maine. Stacy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Stacy, first of all, could you please explain to our listeners what we mean when we say big box store and maybe provide some examples?
Sure. Well, we're really looking at the impact of corporate retailers on the economy. So businesses that are not independent, locally owned retailers, but rather are part of national or even global chains. And so that includes everybody from, you know, Starbucks to Blockbuster to Target to Walmart. Big boxes, in particular, refers to the larger box-like stores that many of these companies open. For example, Home Depot, Lowe's, Target, Staples, Office Max. those kinds of large suburban box stores.
I see. So big box really refers to the fact that it's a big store and it's essentially shaped like a box. It has nothing to do with the things sold by the store in particular.
Yes.
Okay, and then would you say that anything beyond just a single local independent store, any sort of chain, even if it's a small chain, would qualify?
Well, in the book, early on, there's a sort of footnote that says, "What is a locally owned independent business?" Because that's a lot of what I discuss in the book, and what does that really mean? And I define it, and there's no agreed-upon definition, but I define it as a business that's primarily owned by one or more people who live in the community where the business is located, that it's independent, meaning that it doesn't, that the decision-making for the business is entirely in the hands of the local owner, that there's no, corporate headquarters or franchise corporation that they have to follow the rules of. But it isn't truly independent. And then the question is, well, how many outlets might you have and still be considered an independent, locally owned business? And I think if you have two or three, you're still really a local business in most cases. You'll often find the owner right behind the counter in one of those outlets if it's that small. If you get to be a dozen outlets or 15 or 20 outlets, it really starts to become a chain. And there's sort of a gray area in between six or seven outlets where, sometimes it really is truly a local business where the owner is very much connected to the community, and in some cases it's not. It's begun to function much more as a chain.
I see. So it's a function really of not only the number of outlets, but also whether the ownership of the store, of the group of stores or store is local or absentee and remote.
Yes, absolutely. And independent. I think that decision making is really crucial, because franchises, McDonald's or Subway, are ostensibly locally owned. I mean, there's a local entrepreneur who puts up the money and runs the business. But they have to follow all of these dictates handed down to them by the corporate headquarters. So they're really not independent. They can't make a decision, for example, to source some of their supplies from another local business. They have to buy them all from, the McDonald's Corporation. So it really functions like a chain. It doesn't function like an independent business, even though it's somewhat locally owned.
We have, for example, a group of stores out here, Mother's Market. They sell health foods. And they several of the stores, I think, at least have small restaurants that sell health food to the consumers there. And there are four of them, and they're all reasonably local in communities here, all separated by probably 10 or 15 minutes. That would probably qualify as local independent.
Yes, I would see that as a local independent business.
Okay, all right. And then from a historical perspective, can you give us some sense for how big box stores became such an important part of our national landscape? How did that evolution occur?
It's happened very rapidly. It's amazing when you look back at the trends and the gain in market share for these companies. Many of these companies are not that old. We saw the very first sort of big box discount retailers popping up, around the 1970s. But they really didn't start to expand and to multiply at all very much until you start to get into the late 1980s and the early 1990s. Some of these companies are really only 15 or so years old, and yet they grew very dramatically during the 1990s and into the first part of this decade. And the market shares that they have attained are really quite staggering and unprecedented in history that we've had this kind of consolidation. So, for example, Home Depot and Lowe's, which were very small chains 15, 20 years ago, together they now have half of all building supply and hardware sales nationwide. Barnes & Noble and Borders, again, have about half of all bookstore sales in the country. Five companies control half of all grocery sales in the country. The top one now is Walmart. Walmart is the largest grocery retailer in the U.S. And you see this in every sector of retail, whether it's Best Buy in Circuit City in electronics or Blockbuster Video and Hollywood, which together have about 55% of the video rental market, CVS, Rite Aid, and Walgreens, and in drugstores. In every one of these sectors, you've got two or three companies that have grown in the space of about 15 years to really dominate that sector and to control a huge percentage of the market.
I see. Okay. So, and do you have any sort of statistics regarding if we were to divide all the businesses in the United States into, let's say, independently owned versus chain, how that percentage overall has changed over the last 15, 20 years?
I don't. No one actually collects that data. The U.S. Census has a figure that's sort of approximate for it, but it's not. They don't exactly count locally owned versus chain, so we don't really know. But my my best estimate is it's somewhere around 60% is chain and about 40% is locally owned of the whole retail market.
And right probably now. The reverse of that, I would imagine, 15, 20 years ago at least.
Yes, very much so. I mean, it's changed dramatically.
Yeah. And what would you say is the economic imperative that's driving that? If I went to, you know, an executive at Walmart and said, well, why has this trend in the marketplace happened? What is the urge to grow so large and consolidate? What would they say?
Well, these companies really have to, you know, it's the imperative of the way that we've set up our economic system in terms of what the stock market expects. I mean, they really have to grow significantly every year. It's the growth imperative for all of these companies. You know, Walmart, Target, they have to add about 8 to 10% in terms of their floor area every year, meaning they have to build enough stores to grow by about 10% in terms of the amount of acreage that they're taking up out there. I mean, that's what Wall Street expects. And if they fail to meet that kind of growth, then their stock price drops dramatically. So it's very much a growth-based business. And most of these stores, most of these companies, if you look at their financials, what you find is that, you know, half or less of their growth every year comes from expanding sales at existing stores. About two-thirds of their growth typically is coming from opening new outlets. And so that's, you know, they have to continue to put these stores up in order to meet their business model. And the results for local economy and communities has really been quite negative in many respects, but that's their imperative.
Hmm. Boy, it seems like a trend that you know, we've got a finite amount of retail space and, of course, a finite amount of land in the United States. And it seems like a trend that can only go so far. Is there any sort of recognition of this fact that we're pushing the boundaries? At some point, the retail chains, the large big box stores won't be able to grow any further because they won't be able to absorb any additional space?
Well, what's going on now is this kind of cannibalization game, and I write about this at length in the book because it's something that I think people are sort of unaware of, and particularly local officials who are making planning and zoning decisions about these stores. It used to be, and I think a lot of local officials still think that this is the case, that if the reason that a company comes in and wants to open a store in a particular location is that there's market demand that isn't being satisfied, that the consumers need more retail space and that this company's figured that out and so they want to come in and satisfy that demand. That's not the way retail actually works and hasn't for a long time. The way that the retail development works now is that a company says, well, I'm going to go in and build the biggest store around and I'm going to steal market share from other businesses in the community. And that's all that retail development really is shifting those dollars around. And we have gotten on a very fast cycle in terms of, you know, these companies always wanting to open newer and bigger outlets a little further down the road and leaving their existing outlets and older shopping centers vacant. In 1960, we had in the U.S. An average of 4 square feet of retail for every person. And by 1990, that had mushroomed to 19 square feet of retail space for every person. And then over the next 15 years, it doubled. and now we're up to 38 square feet of retail space per person.
That's remarkable.
And, of course, for every one of those square feet of retail space, you also have 3 square feet of parking lot. So when you begin to look at the aggregate acreage of what has been developed, it is really amazing. We've lost a lot of land to retail sprawl and to big box stores. By comparison, in Western Europe, it's about 7 square feet a person. So we are sort of retail space gluttons in the U.S., and it would be one thing if there was actually market demand for all of this space, but the population and our incomes have grown much, much smaller. And there isn't actually demand for all of this retail space, and we now have an epidemic of vacancy. There are over 200 vacant or soon-to-be-vacant malls in the U.S., these big, dark, empty, unused malls sitting everywhere. There are thousands of strip shopping centers that are now vacant, that were built in the 1970s and 1980s. And we've also now got thousands of empty big box stores. Walmart alone, for example, has over 300 empty stores in the U.S. And in many of those cases, what has happened is that Walmart has abandoned a store that's maybe 10 years old, gone down the road a mile or a couple of miles, and built a store that's twice the size, a new super center, and then just let the old one become vacant. And then we've, of course, got a lot of vacancy in our downtowns and our older neighborhood retail districts as well. And so this is just a tremendous waste of resources and of land. It's a tremendously inefficient pattern of development. And we really pay a price in terms of added driving and air pollution, the toxic runoff that comes off all of this pavement and parking lot that we're building is now the number one threat to the nation's rivers and water bodies. So there are all sorts of hidden costs to this pattern of development, but that's the way that things are going right now. Fortunately, there are a lot of communities that are deciding that they don't want to see that kind of pattern of development or taking steps through their land use rules control and curb retail sprawl.
I would imagine that this vacancy epidemic of which you speak is hurting property values in the areas as well. It's got to be a blight on the landscape of towns to have these huge big box carcasses remain empty. I don't imagine that there are a lot of businesses that can fill an old Walmart store, correct?
That's very true, and it does have a very negative. I mean, if you think living next to an active big box store with all the noise and the truck deliveries and the traffic and those big lights in the parking lot, I mean, that alone has a negative value, negative effect on your surrounding property values. But just imagine what it's like when it's vacant and when there's, you know, spray paint on the wall and the parking lot starts to deteriorate. That just sets a sort of tone. You know, if you've got one of those things as a community, it's very hard to get other businesses to want to locate nearby. It just begins to become, as you said, a blight on the neighborhood. Indeed, it is very difficult to refill these boxes, partly because there are very few uses. These are single-story, very cheap buildings that are designed for one purpose. You know, back in the old days, you know, we would build downtown and neighborhood retail districts that had this long-term utility. You know, it may have been a dry goods store 100 years ago, and today it's an internet cafe, but the building itself is still viable all those years later and can be mixed use and reused and recycled in all sorts of ways. A big box store really is useful for only one thing, and there aren't that many retailers that occupy them. And, of course, if you're Walmart, what you do when you vacate a box is you don't want your competitors to get it. You don't want Target to come in there and take over that space. So they actually sit on the leases, and they hang on to these buildings while they're vacant in order to prevent competitors from getting them. And, of course, once if you can't put a retail use in there, what else are you going to do with them? So they do tend to sit vacant for many, many years.
Wow. So Walmart would just prefer to let a store sit empty. I guess you were saying they have 300 stores countrywide here now that are vacant, and they would prefer to let the store sit vacant. And I guess that the community in which the store exists would have no rights to repurpose that land in any way. Is there anything like that going on?
Well, you know, we advise, and a growing number of communities are looking at putting in place some ordinances to try to prevent this sort of thing. I mean, the first thing to get a handle on is don't just okay any kind of the vast majority of communities right now across the U.S., what you find is that they have zoned every bit of land along every major roadway and every highway for commercial development. I mean, you can build shopping centers as far as the eye can see. That's what the zoning allows for now in so many places, and that's a recipe for the kind of vacancy and blight that I'm talking about, because you'll get a shopping center that'll go in, last for maybe 10 years, and then those retail companies decide they're going to go down the road a bit and build some bigger, newer, greater, whatever it is, superstore or shopping center, and they're going to leave that earlier property vacant. Well, the way you control that is not to zone all this land for retail development. It's to really only zone those areas that you want to see retail for retail, and to focus really on building high-quality, mixed-use, neighborhood business districts where you've got local entrepreneurs, apartments and offices above the storefronts, those kinds of long-term, sustainable, high-value, that's the kind of retail that you want, not to allow this sort of single-story retail sprawl to go on forever. So it's really about getting a handle on your zoning as a community. These companies have every incentive to do what they're doing, and it's up to us to draw the line.
Once a big box company exits a store, say 150,000 square foot store or something like that, there's a big box cheap building sitting there vacant in a community, and it's been zoned for retail as you know, it's been zoned improperly, as you would be saying. Is there any recourse for a community to change the zoning or to somehow repurpose that land, or must it just sit there?
You know, at that point, it's become too late. But of course, it's still a matter of prevention. I mean, the easiest, the quickest way to get a vacant Walmart in your community is to allow Walmart to build a new supercenter.
Mm-hmm.
So the best thing to do right now is to just to draw the line and insist that these companies refurbish and expand their existing buildings or not develop this kind of sprawling short-term architecture. So, you know, taking those steps now to prevent that situation in the future is really key. Once you do have a vacant box, it's very difficult. I mean, there have been communities that have actually appropriated tax dollars to buy and tear down these buildings because the negative effect on surrounding properties has been so strong and on the overall image of the community that they've had to do that. But it's a terrible thing to have taxpayers, have all of us, you know, subsidizing the demolition of a building so that, you know, a company like Walmart can make more money.
Oh, wow. So the only way to change the situation for a community is to buy back the property, I guess, from Walmart and to then destroy the store that's there and repurpose it. My goodness, that's amazing.
Yes.
Yeah,
and certainly there's lots that you can do to prevent that from being a future situation.
Sure.
But in terms of what you've already got developed and something going vacant now, you're left holding the bag.
Would you say that big box retailers have different impacts on small versus large communities?
No, it's actually very much. It's actually very similar. What we have found, of course, looking at small towns and rural areas and smaller communities, which were the first places that companies like Walmart tended to develop, and there has been lots of economic research done about what the impacts of these stores are, and quite devastating. I mean, there's a major study that came out this year that tracked the opening of Walmart stores nationwide since the 1970s and found that on average, every time a Walmart store opens, it leads to a net loss of 180 retail jobs.
Mm.
That is, that store puts out so many other businesses in the community that either have to downsize or end up closing altogether and laying off all those workers, that the net loss of jobs is greater, that all those businesses that close end up eliminating more jobs than Walmart creates at its new store. We've also found that there's this ripple of negative effects that goes through the economy because a national retailer doesn't purchase very much in terms of local goods and services. So if you have a local business, a locally owned business, they tend to buy a lot of things in the community. They hire a local accountant, they advertise in the local newspaper, they bank at the local bank, they've got, you know, local guy who does their website, you know, so forth and so on. They spend all of this money right there with other businesses in the community, and in that way, your Main Street stores are not only, you know, their economic activity, but they support all of these other businesses in the community. That's not the case with a national chain, whether it's Starbucks or Walmart. Most of the dollar that you spend in that store leaves. It doesn't stay in the local economy. It doesn't go to support any local jobs outside of the jobs in the store itself. That's it. It doesn't support any other local businesses. So there's a tremendous negative ripple effect when you have a big box retailer come into a community, put out all of those local businesses, and then start draining dollars from the local economy. I use the metaphor in the book of colonization. I mean, it's really very much a kind of colonizing of our local economies that these companies do, where they come in and they extract more wealth than they contribute to the local economy. Those effects are exactly the same in a big city, and what we're seeing now is all of these retailers have really saturated the suburbs, they've saturated the small towns, and they are looking for places to grow, and the last place where they can grow are in urban neighborhoods. And so we're seeing all of these companies trying to build stores in Chicago and New York and Los Angeles, in bigger cities, but the effects are exactly the same. On a neighborhood, when you have a Walmart open, it's all those local businesses in the neighborhood that go, all those jobs that are lost, all those dollars that are extracted.
So we've talked about toxic runoff. We've talked about the blight on the neighborhood. We've talked about job flight, jobs leaving the community, particularly from small businesses. We've talked about a variety of different things. Let's lay it on the line for the listeners and just, can you tick off all the various detrimental effects that big box retailers have on communities in general, adding to the list that I've started?
Well, sure. On the economic front, I guess there are a couple of others that I would name. Is the loss that I talked a little bit about in terms of what happens to a dollar that goes into a Walmart versus a dollar that goes into a locally owned business. One of the effects that we're seeing is the loss of manufacturing jobs in the U.S. And all sorts of local production. Local farmers, for example, small family farmers, they can't sell into these big chain stores. And as the local grocers disappear, they begin to lose their outlets for their products. And that's the same thing is true for all sorts of small producers across the country, whether you're a small manufacturer of toys, or you're a small publisher of books, or you're a family farmer. Your lifeline are local independent retailers, because you're too small. The big boys aren't going to deal with you. And so that's another sector of the economy that's being harmed by the growth of companies like Walmart and Target. Another big economic effect that we're now discovering is that the cost of these stores from a public infrastructure and services standpoint is very expensive. There's an enormous drain that they place on local governments because they require a lot of road maintenance costs because of all the traffic that they generate. And they also generate a tremendous number of police calls for various reasons. And so there are all of these towns across the country that are now reporting that the cost of providing public services to big box stores actually exceeds the tax revenue that they're getting from the store.
Interesting.
And so the effect is that residents and other people in the community are, in effect, having to subsidize that store through their tax dollars. And we talked some about the environmental impacts, and then the other two big areas that I talk about in the book of impact, one is on the effect on community life of trading our local businesses for national chains. And there's a fascinating sociological studies that have been done in the last few years that have found that communities that have a larger number of locally owned businesses are much healthier socially and civically. They score higher on all of these measures of community health. People are much more likely to become involved in civic and neighborhood organizations. They're much more likely to attend school board meetings and city council meetings, and they're much more likely to vote which I think is fascinating. And sociologists who are doing this research are still sort of teasing out what the range of reasons are for that. But there is this connection between local businesses and the health of your community that's very important. And then the last piece that I would mention is the impact on consumers. As these retail chains have taken over, there's this sort of this paradox kind of thing that's going on where, on the one hand, it seems like the opening of a Target brings all of this selection in terms of the range of goods, but in fact, it's dramatically narrowing the range of goods that are available. To take one example, if you look in the book industry, Borders and Barnes & Noble, which now have about half of all bookstore sales, when you walk into one of these stores and you think, wow, you know, look at all of these books. But those are basically the same books that they have in all of their outlets nationwide. They have this centralized buying where you have a handful of buyers at each of these companies that are choosing what books go into those stores. And the result is that as they have taken over and as independent bookstores have declined in numbers, there has been this narrowing of the range of things that is available and that we read. And that's true in every retail sector because all of the diversity of producers out there, as I mentioned before, can't sell into these chains. They deal with one or two big companies that can supply them. And the result is that the range of products that are available on store shelves is becoming less and less diverse, and we have fewer and fewer choices about not only where to shop, but what we can buy.
You know, I heard about Walmart in particular. Perhaps you can verify this. I'm not sure if it's true, but I heard along those lines that from a political standpoint, the owners of a big box chain, of course, you know, have political views of various sorts. And I guess that I heard that Walmart had actually banned a couple of books, one by George Carlin and one very popular book, I imagine, by Jon Stewart recently. You just couldn't find on their shelves because the people who own the big box chain didn't want them there. Is that something that you can verify?
Yes, that's true. They have Walmart has not allowed certain kinds of books, certain books to be sold in their stores. They also don't allow certain kinds of magazines to be sold in their stores. And I think what, you know, individually any of these, I think what begins to happen that's actually more scary in a way, it would be one thing if Walmart were just one of many, many retailers. But in a lot of communities, it's the only place where you can buy certain kinds of goods. It may be the only place that sells magazines and books in some small towns, or the only place that sells music. Many recording artists now make two albums. They make one that's their real album, and they make one that they sell to Walmart. Or they just adjust everything to meet Walmart standards because they have very strict standards about lyrics and that kind of thing, cover art, and what they will and will not allow in their stores. And there are a lot of places out there where Walmart is the only place in your community where you can buy music, and so you're shut out as a result of that. But I think even more scary in a way is then what begins to happen in the minds of publishers and the minds of the record companies. They begin to self-censor because they know that something is not, if they suspect something isn't going to be palatable to their biggest customers, they're not going to produce it in the first place. So it never even gets to the point where it's banned from the store shelf because the publishers and the record companies are already not producing that kind of stuff that they don't think would be of interest. It was intriguing when I my book is published by Beacon Press, which is a small, wonderful independent publisher based in Boston. And I, because of the nature of the book, when I was thinking about the proposal, I really thought it'd be great to find an independent publisher. I mean, that sort of makes sense, mm-hmm. right? With what I'm writing about. But I have an agent, and she sort of insisted that we send the proposal out to lots of different publishers, so that was really, you know, the best way to go. And so she did. And we had more than one of the major publishers write back to us and say, point blank, this book is too critical of Borders and Barnes & Noble, and those are our biggest customers. So there's no way. We think this looks like a very interesting and worthwhile book, but there's no way we can publish this.
My goodness. So really we're seeing not only choice exercised by the big box chain, but we're seeing a backlash impact on the production of art, basically, in the form of people writing books or producing certain kinds of records. They just don't do that kind of thing anymore because they don't believe that it will be palatable. That is just an amazing thing. Let me ask you, going back just a second to the topic you were talking about earlier, the economic impact on a community. I've also read that small communities in particular, for which a new Walmart would make such a huge difference in the tax base, are offering huge subsidies to stores like Walmart and Target and other big box stores to come there. So that's an additional taxpayer cost as well, right?
Yes, it is. I started doing work and research on this whole issue back in the, I guess, late 1990s, and over the years have been just stunned to discover that we really, the perception is that these companies have gotten so big simply because of market forces, because that's where consumers are choosing to shop. That's what everyone seems to think. But in fact, they have grown, they owe their rapid rise in no small part to government policy. All levels of government, local, state, federal, have really, in a variety of ways, actively undermine the survival of independent businesses while underwriting the growth of these large companies. And we see the favoritism. Our policy, public policy, is just riddled with favoritism for big business and hurdles for local independent stores. And I've just been shocked as I uncover more and more of these kinds of things over the years. The subsidies that you mention are probably the most visible example. No one knows exactly how much these retailers have picked up in development subsidies, and these are subsidies where the local government, Walmart comes and says, we want to build a store, will you give us $3 million to offset our cost? And the local government buys the idea that this is going to be good for the local economy, and they give them the $3 million, or they give them a big tax break or whatever else. No one knows what the value of all of those subsidies are, but we know it's somewhere in the billions of dollars that have been given to these big corporations. There was one study that looked at Walmart subsidies and found that Walmart, over the last 10 years or so, has picked up over $1 billion in local subsidies from governments around the country. And just imagine if we took all of that money and instead of spending it subsidizing these big companies, we started entrepreneurship programs in our communities where we could help folks get started and grow local businesses. I mean, we really could have done so much more with that money than we have. But there are also other examples. I discovered that recently that about half of all of the states have these tax loopholes that enable national chains to escape all or part of their tax obligations in these states, whereas an independent business that only has one outlet in its home state can't. It has to pay taxes on 100% of its earnings, so it's at a tremendous disadvantage from a tax perspective. And there are all kinds of we've really failed to enforce the kind of antitrust provisions that are important to retailers. Those have largely been unenforced by the federal government for many years. There are all kinds of regulatory advantages that big chains have that local businesses don't. And so it's really a rigged playing field. And I think that that's a crucial reason why we've got to get involved in addressing some of the public policy issues around this.
Yeah. Okay, if we're taking the devil's advocate viewpoint for just a minute, Stacy. Some would say, and I know you've probably heard this, that the appearance of big box stores and the disappearance of small independent stores is simply a natural phenomenon resulting from consumers choosing low price and convenience over other criteria when they shop. One can certainly argue that we the people had a choice and we have chosen these big box stores over small ma-and-pa stores. What would be your reply?
Well, part of the problem is that we pay a tremendous cost for these stores that doesn't show up on their price tag. And so when you so consumers may be making a choice when they don't see all of the hidden costs associated with these stores, and some of that cost is the loss of local jobs, the diminishing of the of your economy. I think that what has happened is we think that we're saving money shopping at these places, But in fact, we're losing income faster than we're saving money as a result of the growth of these stores and the impact that they have had on small business and manufacturing and on local economies, where they are dramatically undercutting and getting rid of jobs and lowering putting pressure, downward pressure on wages across all of these sectors of the economy. So I think we're paying a much higher price in terms of our income. I think we're paying a very high price in terms of our communities and the health of our communities, a high price in terms of the tax subsidies that go to these stores, a high price in terms of the effect that they have on the environment, all of the pollution that is associated, the runoff from the parking lots, the added air pollution of all the driving that we're now doing for shopping that we weren't doing 15 years ago. So there are all of these hidden costs that don't show up on the price tag. And there are also all of these what one might say are hidden benefits to doing business at places that are owned by people who live in your community. And we don't see those things. And so part of what the work that I'm trying to do and the talks that I give around the country is to make those hidden costs apparent to people. But the other issue is that, as I mentioned, the government, public policy has really subsidized these big retailers. It is not a level playing field at all, and that they have grown in part because they've gotten all of these handouts and help from government that has not been available to independent businesses. So it's a tilted playing field and is very much a rigged system in that regard as well. And lastly, I would just say we have to be a little bit wary about this idea that these retailers are the lowest cost option. They're very sophisticated in how they price their products. There's a whole chapter on pricing in the book because I wanted to sort of expose some of the kinds of tricks and things that these companies get up to. For example, many of them use a pricing practice called signposts and blinds, where they price certain products well below cost. And so you walk in the door of a Home Depot, for example, and you see a product that's just incredibly cheap that's displayed very prominently at the front of the store, and it creates this impression in your mind that the whole store is low cost. But in fact, studies have compared Home Depot to local hardware stores and found that they're very much price competitive. And that's because local hardware stores, like many retailers, belong to these big wholesale buying cooperatives. So they get the same volume discounts and that sort of thing that the big chains do. So I think it's really, and we also find in many cases that these retailers, they come into a community with very low prices, and then once they've eliminated the competitors, the prices then begin to rise. So I think as consumers, we got to be very wary of the idea that allowing one or two companies to dominate our local retail markets is going to be good for us. I mean, that's not competition. That's a lack of competition. And in the long run, that's going to be very damaging to us just in purely consumer terms.
So really, to summarize, it's kind of a pay me now or pay me later kind of situation. It seems that, you know, if we choose to have Walmarts and Targets and other big box stores in our community, we're choosing quote, low price and convenience. That's what it looks like in a very simplistic way to the consumer. But really, when we buy from a store like that, we're setting off essentially a series of things that happen within that community that we may not be quite so aware of and that we probably wouldn't like. And all the things that we've talked about are certainly included in that. And as you've mentioned just recently, add to that the deception of the fact that sometimes these stores will price certain items in certain ways, and sometimes they'll come into a community with low prices, which they can afford because they're so large, and then raise the prices once they've eliminated the competition. And of course, if a local business was doing that and their kids were going to school with your kids, they probably wouldn't be able to feel very comfortable about that. But you know, if there's absentee ownership and, you know, the store is headquartered somewhere far away, it doesn't make that much of a difference to them. So really, it's, I guess, a pay me now, pay me later situation.
I think that's very true. I think that's very true. And we're on the path with these companies because of that ripple effect, you know, the sending the manufacturing overseas, destroying opportunities for small manufacturers and small producers to make a living, killing these key pillars of the American middle class. I mean, small business owners and people who used to have good high-wage manufacturing jobs. I mean, those key sectors of the American middle class are being decimated by these companies. And in fact, if you look, what you see is over the last 20 years, the middle class in the U.S. has actually been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And meanwhile, the ranks of the working poor, people who work full-time but cannot make enough money to get by, has been growing and growing and growing. And I think the reason that we're seeing that shift in our economy has a whole lot to do with the growth of Home Depot and Target and Walmart and the kind of economic models that they're imposing on our communities. So, you know, we think we're saving a buck now, but we are paying for it in a big way in the whole, if you look at the big picture.
And in many ways, we're paying for it even now, I suppose, because, of course, it's our tax dollars that go towards the subsidies and the, you know, the other tax breaks and sorts of things that contribute to these big box retailers having an even more uneven playing field. So, so it's a good thing for all of us to think about when we're shopping. Now, let's talk just for the last few minutes about the backlash. Would you say that there's a backlash growing against big box retailers? Is it gaining momentum at this time?
Absolutely. This has just exploded in the last few years. The number of communities where there are citizens groups who have stopped big box development, who are changing their local land use policies to prevent that kind of development, and who are working on economic development strategies to grow local businesses, to revive their local economies. I mean, it's really taken off in the last couple of years. Excuse me. The whole last half of my book is actually really looks at what communities are doing, and I think it was very inspiring for me to do the research and to write that part, because there's so many interesting things going on at the local level. There really is this broad grassroots movement out there that has where people are realizing that we are paying a huge price, and they're actively looking and developing ways to reverse those trends.
Cite some examples for us, if you would.
Sure. There are a number of communities, as I mentioned, that have initiated policies locally that prohibit big box development. For example, this year, a whole swath of towns in along coastal Maine held referendums and passed local ordinances that ban big box stores, that say no stores over 35,000 square feet, which is about one-sixth the size of a typical Walmart, are going to be allowed in these communities. They've said they want to have local businesses and thriving downtowns. That's happening all over the country. There are states now where there is legislation to require economic and community impact studies before any new retail development of a certain size can be approved. So really getting the facts on the tables about the job losses and the impact on businesses and the tax base, you know, before a decision is made about whether to approve one of these developments. Vermont became the first state to close that loophole, that tax loophole that I was talking about for chain stores just this year. We're hoping other states will now follow. So there's a lot happening on the policy front locally and at the state level. We have seen this, incidentally, in the last 3 years, over 200 big box stores have been stopped by community opposition, and many hundreds more have been slowed down and delayed and are still being fought about. So there's a lot of grassroots opposition that's being successful against these developments. Another thing that I think is really interesting and very encouraging that's happening out there is there are now independent business alliances in about four dozen cities across the U.S., and they're multiplying rapidly. And what these are alliances of local independent businesses, usually several hundred in a community. So, for example, there's the Austin Independent Business Alliance in Austin, Texas, that has about 400 independent business members. And there are similar alliances that have sprung up all over the place. And these are groups that are doing campaigns, some sort of marketing and public education campaigns around the idea of supporting locally owned businesses and why that matters and what the benefits of shopping locally are. And these campaigns have been enormously successful in the places where they've been going on for a few years. Just to go back to the Austin example, locally owned has now become such a strong selling point in Austin, something that consumers are really looking for, that shopping center developers in Austin, folks who've been developing shopping centers and redeveloping some parts of the city, have been hearing in these neighborhood surveys they do. They do the customer surveys to figure out what kinds of business to put in their shopping centers, have been hearing so strongly from residents that they don't want to see chains. They don't want to see Starbucks and Borders in those shopping centers. They want to see locally owned businesses. To the point where these big shopping center developers have now come to the Austin Independent Business Alliance and said, "Help us! We want to get local entrepreneurs in our developments. We've never done that before. We don't know how to do it. How do we do it?" So really, changing the way that people think in these communities and making locally owned something that is really considered when people make their shopping decisions. So I'm very encouraged by all of those. As I said, there are about four dozen of them now around the country, and every day it seems like I hear about a new one that's forming.
It's heartening to hear that over 200 stores have been turned down by their communities. I think that one happened fairly recently here in the LA area in Inglewood. I believe that there were efforts to try to install a Walmart store in that community, and some of the community leaders rose up and in protest and eventually stopped the Walmart. It's actually interesting. Walmart does not have a huge presence in the Los Angeles area right now, but of course, as you mentioned, Los Angeles is a very urban area, and Walmart has mostly been active in rural and suburban communities, but we're just starting to see incursions at this point of big box stores. Certainly there are a lot of others, but Walmart has lagged behind some of the others, like Target in this particular area. If people want to keep big box stores out of their communities, what are the three most important things that you recommend they do?
Well, first of all, I should say that my organization has a couple of websites that provide hands-on tools and information for doing just that. So we've got a bunch of resources that make the local work much more doable for citizens. One is a new website that we just launched called bigboxtoolkit.com. And there you can go download fact sheets and posters and presentations and all of we've got a library of all of the big studies that have been done about the economic impacts of these stores. So you can go up there and get all the information that you need in a format that's easy to present to your neighbors and to local elected officials about what the true cost of these stores are. The other thing is that we have up there are policy kits, and this is really crucial. We have kits for doing local ordinances that will either control or prohibit big box development in your community. And there are a few different ways that you can go with those ordinances. Many communities are adopting store size caps where they've essentially said no retail stores over a certain size. That's one way to go, and there are lots of advantages to that, lots of places that have done it. Other communities are requiring these economic impact studies to be done and public hearings so that a big box store isn't just an automatic approval, but it really has to pass a test, and you can say no if you don't think it passes the test. And so there are examples of ordinances up there. One of the really wonderful important aspects of all of this, big business has such a stranglehold on Congress and so often on our state governments because of their campaign donations. But the real power when it comes to retail development is not actually at the state or the federal level. It's at the local level. Cities have an enormous authority over land use and development, and courts give them very broad leeway to pass laws to control and set standards for development. So there's a lot that you can do at the local level. You have a tremendous amount of power at the local level over retail, and that's one of the encouraging things about this issue is that communities can do a lot. They have a lot of control.
That's reassuring to hear. Okay, well, I think that we're just about out of time. Stacy, we've been Our guest has been Stacy Mitchell. She's a senior researcher with the New Rules Project, a program of the Nonprofit Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Stacy's latest book, of which we've been speaking, is Big Box Swindle, The True Cost of Mega Retailers and the Fight for America's Independent Business, published by Beacon Press this year, 2006. Stacy, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That's it for today. Stay tuned, because next up is Serena Sharp with The Sharp Show, Hot Topics You Really Care About. I know you want to listen to that, and I'll be back next week with another installment of Corporations Behaving Badly. This is Steve Spanier, your host. Once again, here's Mike Stout taking us out with his song Big Time Corporate Blues, and you're listening to KUCI in Irvine.
The big time.